Hey everyone, welcome back to Escape from Plan A. It's a free episode. Well, I don't know if it's free. Maybe it's a bonus. I don't know, but it's an episode. And returning friend of the pod, John Pang. How's it going, man?
Hi. Good, thank you. How are you doing?
Not as well as you. Apparently, you're ready to leave the nest to escape the coop and
yeah,
out of here. Yeah, you got your ticket on the riverboat, and you're gonna paddle across the Pacific. Is that how it's gonna go?
Yep. I'm not gonna say much about it yet until I get out of here because you know I don't want to jinx it.
Oh man, you know I told you this is like a thing that I feel like more and more people are getting the tip, you know, that maybe the future is elsewhere. You know what I mean?
Yeah, we should. You've probably done a pod on this, but we should really get at this. I'm seeing people talk about it more and actually do it, and you know, chime in from across the Pacific.
Yeah,
yeah. We should talk about it, and I'll certainly talk about it.
I gather we could still do this when you're over there. Well, the timing will be a little bit more difficult. We'll have to figure out like a median time.
Well, but it'll just be like with Carl. I'll be in the same time zone.
That's true. It'll be a different thing when you're actually there. You know, it'll be less theoretical and more. Dude, I'm completely. You got to understand. I'm in a completely different situation.
Yeah. Right now, yeah. You know? Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly, and I will be looking at this place from an actual distance. I always feel as if I'm distant, even though I'm in the middle of it. But yeah,
nothing seems real here, you know. And
yes,
though it's getting more and more real, and I think more and more people are waking up to the realness of it.
That's quite the feeling.
We'll
yeah.
See. I don't know, man. We'll see. I don't know if I'm just online and I'm seeing other people. You know, it's like a self-selecting group, obviously, on Twitter and stuff. That's seeing this. I think.
No, I think it's not just our little group, right? This sense of unreality. I think we're talking about the same thing. But the last few years have been crazy, and I think that's part of the premise behind the space we do and. It's the background to a lot of our conversations, and the need to talk about it because it really is mind bending, the changes we're seeing, and it's exhausting. The other day, I think you tweeted this, right? You talked about people just being exhausted, and it's literally true. It isn't just psychologically so, but people are actually feeling it physiologically. I don't know why, but. Yeah, I feel it too. This tiredness.
Yeah,
it's more than a metaphor.
This feeling of like, time is not really. It's like we're in the same moment for the past 10 years. It's not. It's like almost like we're not really going forward in time. I just realized the other day that like, not very far down the road, it's going to be 2030, and 2030 is officially. Like deep future, like that's 2030 is when we should have been exploring intergalactic space with Android, this and that, whatever, and space mining.
I'm an old guy.
2030 is going to look like this if not
exactly
worse.
Exactly. It's a sort of space odyssey that, but even that was way back. But I'm an old guy. I grew up with this TV series, Space 1999, that really dates me. You know, the it was about this moon colony. These people had a colony on the moon by 1999, and I kind of always imagined, as a kid, I tried to imagine what it would be like to do things like this, and I fully expected to be an astronaut. I fully expected stuff like that, and it's just
really
the same.
Happened? Mm-hmm. If you go back to 1969 when we first got to the moon, and then you say, what it's going to be like in 2023, and there'll be like cities on the moon, and you're like, no, we never go back to the moon. In fact, it's so long, it's been so long since we've been to the moon that like 50% of the country believes we never actually went there and it was all fake.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. We literally and can't believe the world that we actually outside did the US. That anymore.
Exactly, exactly. They think we faked it. Because we seem to have forgotten how to get back there and to do things which don't even amount to that technological feat, done with computers less powerful than your phone.
It reminds me, you know, when I was a kid, it always blew my mind that in the medieval period, they had lost a lot of the knowledge and wisdom from the antiquity era, from the classical era.
Yep.
And they literally had the ruins of this ancient past that they didn't like, that was a sort of a like more advanced than they were, you know, like they were living in the ruins of something that was more advanced than they were. And I'm like, is that us? Are we living in the ruins of like a once great, you know, country, you know, or whatever? Like,
It's not a feeling that is foreign or alien to many cultures. Many sort of look back to not quite a golden age, but to people wiser than ourselves, right? Certainly in the Chinese tradition. And I think even the Greeks looked back, and it turns out that actually human society or civilization is a lot older than we thought it was. So I think it's fascinating how recent discoveries really push back, you know, the beginning of urbanization or civilization. So it's actually a lot older, and it's only we in this society and in it's a liberal it's a assumption of liberalism that we're far smarter than anything before us. But people did live with that sense. They did see ruins around them and imagine, rightly or not, that people were smarter before, and there was always this sense of having to recover. That's what the whole kind of warring states thing in Chinese thought is about. It's sort of recovering the Zhou, recovering the, you know, the wisdom of previous generations, previous dynasty.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like a restoration kind of thing.
Restoration.
Yeah.
It's only we who think that, why is that a weird idea? Well, because we have a notion of history that's supposed to be onward, upward all the time. There's no cyclicality to our notion of history.
Our arc is so compressed in time too. We're talking a matter of decades. We're talking in the realm of decades.
Yeah.
And there's already like a growing cultural mining of this. There's a nostalgia industry, let's put it that way, that sort of idealizes late 70s, 80s now.
Yeah.
To an extent, the 90s as a sort of golden age, and without any real regard for the current time, other than as a place to look, a vantage point to look back on the past. That's all really the present is.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's
a frighteningly shallow past. It's 20, a few decades.
It is. It's only,
This is not Botticelli or, you know,
yeah, exactly.
Michelangelo looking back.
Yeah, you know, it's. I think it has a lot to do with the. I think there's a real nostalgia for a somewhat more pre-digital, pre-internet age. I think there's a lot of blaming, maybe scapegoating. I don't know, but there's certainly a lot of blame, I think, on digital, and particularly like mobile digital smartphones. Okay.
Changing
society. Though I'm not sure. I think that process was already in play. But certainly there's this feeling like, before we were all staring at our phones, you know, we used to be a country, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
How much that era actually represented something great, I don't know. I don't think it's as great as we remember. But hey, you know.
Hey, but we at least remember. We're old enough to remember. We're sort of the transitional generation. I don't know about you, but I grew up in a time when we still kind of as kids wrote letters. You know, I had a pen pal, things like that. You know, I wrote letters to friends, and I remember my first computer. It was first seeing one in school in the computer club, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So we do remember what it felt like
Well, yeah. And well, I hope that what's going on now is going to wake people up to realize, like, the present is more than just a platform, a viewing platform to the past. You know, like, it is its own moment, and are people, you know, are we living up to this moment? And I don't know, man. I've never felt this way before about anything in terms of a national or international story that, you know, a mega crisis, a geopolitical crisis, you know. Yeah. So often I think we are conditioned to view these events as a kind of heightened form of entertainment, that this is something that is a crisis unfolding with great drama, and yes, people are, you know, tune in to the news networks and read, you know, they're refreshing their news feed and social media, and it's an entertainment, and people follow these, like, people were following the Ukraine war like a football match, which I found really disturbing, but that is what we do. And
yes, yes.
And I thought, you know, you guys are playing with fire here. I mean, like, this could have serious. Now we're talking about another fucking conflagration that's fallen upon us. And I really, really hope that this is that rupture that finally makes it rips a hole in the belief system that we all are operating under, which I believe is a mandatory belief system. It's
yes,
not,
yes,
it's not something that we choose. And I'm really hoping that it tears a fucking hole right in that fabric, so we can all begin to understand, like, guys, we are living in captivity. We're not choosing to sit back and watch entertainments from the comfort of our home.
Exactly.
We're fucking prisoners.
Yeah. Yeah. I had the same thought, actually. Mm. I posted, right, this thing in which I had the same image struck me. It was as if the, you know, you're in the simulation, and then there's a tear in the fabric of the simulation, in the world of the simulation. And then you start to see the cogs and the machine behind it. You know,
things that are happening that just don't make sense.
Yes,
they're not supposed to happen.
We've had all
happening.
These different crises, but this one—it's suddenly a kind of epistemological crisis. Your whole way of evaluating the world is kind of challenged. I mean, we're cynical enough about the way things operate internationally, but you didn't expect it to be blatant to this degree. It's not just that. Oh, you and I realize, or we learn that, oh, you know, international affairs are, you know, are conducted with that Israel, for example, has this kind of pretty brutal settler colonial logic to it. No, theoretically, you know this. And this thing is, it's possible to somehow keep some of it under wraps or under control. But they then come out and just say it. And then, for example, watching the bombings and of innocent, the killing of innocents, these are war crimes. But done, well, if you do it, you don't announce it and sort of, you know, exult in it. I don't know. That it's just so blatant, so in your face. And then you have all these Western leaders rushing to go to Tel Aviv, right? To offer support and endorse and green light this. All this while almost on a split screen, you see what's happening in Beijing. You see 100 leaders from 150 countries gather, you know, to talk about development and, you know, boring stuff like development, connectivity, cooperation. It's just really jarring. You didn't expect the thing to reveal itself so very, very blatantly, and I guess I'm you know, struggling with trying to put that.
You mentioned the billboard, which someone posted into this group chat the billboard with that has the yes. Israeli flag. It's a yes. digital billboard, humongous.
Yes, Times Square.
Yeah, and it's funny. It's off to the side. You can see Morgan Stanley on the right. So you know this is right in the middle of probably Midtown Financial District where all the banks are, Midtown, right on the side of a mm-hmm. building, mm-hmm. giant LED billboard, two of them yeah. on top yeah. of each other, Israeli flag next to it. It said, "Be human," white text, and then a red little dot. I don't know if that is meant to conjure up blood or something. "Be human," period. "Support Israel," period. That's it. And with this giant Star of David flag next to it, and I'm like, is this a movie set? Like, what the hell is this? "Be human," "Support Israel." I immediately was like, okay, so you're telling me if I don't support Israel, I'm not human? Or what? Like, what is this message? "Be human." Like, what does that mean? Why are we talking about being human? Why is that in the lingo now? Because this is clearly about dehumanizing a population. We are in the stage of called dehumanization, which is a 10-step process in as detailed by the Holocaust Museum of what the 10 steps of genocide are, and one of them is dehumanization. And I'm like, there's the word "human" is showing up too often for me to feel good. That the number of babies,
amazing.
The mention of babies and butchered.
That's a hugely important observation, and I want to get back to this. Yes,
it's just too much, man. I now look at this. I'm like, guys, are you seeing what I'm seeing? So I had to post this.
I just saw it about a couple of hours ago when you posted it. I couldn't believe it. What the fuck am I looking at, right?
Yeah.
So I did a reverse image search. I tried to see, can they really do this?
Because please tell me it's fake or AI or something.
No, I found people, it was there. It's part of this billboard, and that red dot is part of the design language of this thing. I suppose it has different messages. But this "Be human," stand for Israel, right? "Be human," stand for Israel. Mm-hmm. This is the very opposite of an appeal to your humanity. It's not an appeal to humanity. It's an appeal, or it's not even an appeal. It's declarative. It's
bullying statement.
It's a bullying thing. Exactly. It's declarative. It's, as you said, I'm telling you what is the case.
Yeah.
Right. It's instructions to take the right side in this war. And the right side is the side of the humans against the non-humans, the pre-humans, the inhumans,
mm-hmm.
whatever it is. So you're drawing
side
that line out there. And it's
side
just
with
you.
The humans. This is what they're flying this.
Yes, yes.
In fucking Midtown Manhattan with this giant Star of David. And I'm like, this looks like the set of a science fiction movie of some alternative future where there's all the sides are reversed, man. And
this
weird.
Is like one of
I'm
the,
like, what the
ads
fuck is this?
In Starship Troopers. Okay.
Yeah.
It's like one of the ads that show up there.
That's exactly what my friend said, by the way. He was like, this is like Starship Troopers. That's exactly what one of my other friends said. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're walking along, and you're minding your own business, and there's this tear in the fabric of, human decency. Right. And this really blatantly, how do I say it? I couldn't find a way of reading it that wasn't Nazi. Okay.
Yeah, that's what it is. It's some Nazi.
I tried. I tried. Break this principle of charity. Okay, so because it just tells you what to do here.
Yeah.
The other thing is, it just tells you. It's so sure of itself. As you said, who's this really aimed at? As you said, it seems to be aimed not at as proles,
no,
but at the elite.
Yeah, it's aimed at Morgan Stanley.
you know what to do here.
Yeah.
You know what you guys know what to do here, and so on. So there's the presumption that we share this this ontology with them, straight up. There's the humans, and there's the non-humans or the inhuman. Yeah, amazing. And par for the course. It's quite, you know, it's not even exceptional, just the moment we're in. And it is tiring.
Yeah, so today, you know, what do New York City shitlibs do when we want to express solidarity with a foreign country? We go to eat at that. We go to eat at a restaurant that serves the food, the ostensible food of that country. So, Shannon and I went to go eat falafel at a Palestinian-owned restaurant today. We didn't go out of our way to do that, but we were in the neighborhood, and I was in the mood for Middle Eastern snacks. And so we went in, and I got this distinct feeling like, I bet you I'm going to see someone I recognize in here from Twitter, or, you know, like a pro-Palestinian activist or something. And in walks this guy who I saw on a video. He's a pro-Palestinian activist who I've been told, I don't go to the rallies or anything, I'm not an activist. But I saw him on Twitter, and I've heard people talk about him. He shows up at all the rallies and does this very emotive theatrical performance where his hands are shaking and he's like, "Dead babies!" I remember seeing it on Twitter going, you know, this is not helping, because I don't know what the point of these hysterics are. Like, that's not.
Yeah.
I just don't think that this is driving people away. This performance of this is just trying to outdo everyone. This is about attention seeking, and it's about making it about yourself. And
just so often the shit live thing.
Yeah. So I'm sitting there eating. Well, and you know, it's like, okay, look, you're on the right side. Okay, fine. But I'm just telling you, I personally don't. I'm not about that shit. I'm just not a big believer in liberal activism, because I think that it's mostly about chasing your own tail. We can talk about that later. But it's meant to wear the people out, and it doesn't matter. They don't care about that anyway. They're not going to listen to you. It doesn't make a damn bit of difference. They're just finding ways for you to wear yourself out and not pay attention to the thing that they're going to do. And after we finished, I was like, dude, I got to go to, let's just get out of here. And then we were walking, and we walked by the Basilica of St. Patrick's over in Nolita, which is a beautiful church, especially at night. It's lit up. And so we walked in for the 7 p.m. service. And by the way, all the clergy guys are like Asians. There were like two Chinese guys and an Indian guy. Very, very fascinating. The priest or the I don't know if he's like a, what his title is, but he wears like a green frock. I don't know if that means anything to you. But he was delivering this very the speech about Martin Scorsese films, because Martin Scorsese had gone to the school attached to that, the Paris school attached there, and filmed a lot of the scenes in Mean Streets, apparently, in that church.
Oh.
And he said, this is about a movie. This had nothing to do with anything that, you know, I'm thinking about. But he was just talking about sort of like themes about life and these movies and Sid and all this stuff. And he said, a common theme across all of Scorsese's movies, from The Color of Money to, you know, Gangs of New York to Mean Streets, all of them, is that we are born into a fallen world from which there is no escape. And I was like, God damn. I wanted to stand up and clap that one. I was like, holy shit, man, that's bleak as hell. And I like it. I'm like that you're delivering this bleak message of what's going on. Because that is what it is. That is not a liberal statement. That is a statement.
It is not a liberal statement.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's precisely about the loss of that view.
Yeah.
And it's bleak only.
Oh, it's bleak.
As background to hope, to something else.
Yeah.
But it's to me, it's realistic.
Oh,
it's real. Yeah. That it is like that.
Yeah.
Um,
that was a good one.
But we lost that. This is a basic thing. And it's in, of course, the Christian tradition, but it's in other traditions as well, a certain grown-upness about, yeah, about reality,
yep,
about social and historical reality, which we've lost.
Yeah, it's a childish worldview that we have outside of serious traditions.
Exactly.
Of this juvenile optimism, and I would say a social hostility towards questions about bleakness. And I'm like, yeah. Well, the guy just said it. Why don't you come to mass with me next time? He said it. Dude, he said, we are born into a fallen world from which there is no escape. I'm in the church, bro. I'm not on Twitter. This is, I'm in church.
Did
you hear him?
Yeah.
And he's not talking about anything. Oh, he's just talking about Scorsese films, you know?
Yeah. But
that was the highlight of
it's in the creed. It's fundamental. Fallen nature, a fallen world, and people think that this is this is just these Catholics being doomers.
Yeah,
and it's actually the very opposite of that. But first, you have to have a realistic sense of where things are, and people have known this. I was just in fact. You know, it's a striking coincidence. I was talking, I took a walk with my wife and we were just talking about this, about how the elite discourse is, you know, the way they relate to one another and talk to and talk about what they're about to do, say politically, they inhabit a juvenile moral a moral order.
Yeah,
it's really what, you know.
It's what you would tell a child that wasn't ready to hear the truth about what happened to the family dog.
Right, right.
You know,
if your child started talking like this, for example, Biden's speech, you know, recent speech asking for $105 billion extra, this amazing speech he gave, this horrifying speech he gave. Right, and talking about what's happening in Israel, Palestine, and linking it to Ukraine, and you know, pitching for money there, and also, by the way, some money for the Indo-Pacific to counter China. It was really a kind of war speech, but the moral concepts he was appealing to, the type of person who talks like this. In every, you know, civilized society is a person who's not properly developed. You would say this is a juvenile. This is, you don't understand, for example, that hubris precedes a fall, that you are courting your own destruction by talking like that, by having no sense of yourself. It was almost a reprise of 30 years ago, where the exceptional nation. In that sense, what you said at the beginning is, it's always, nothing has changed. It's as if we cycle around to these dead cliches, as if nothing has happened, and yet so much has happened. It really felt like these people are moral midgets, moral children. There is no sense of development. And I'm talking about development in terms of the development of people.
You know, you know what it is? I think part of it is it has to be the fact that there is no profit to be made in confronting the constraints of this world, right? There's no
end of
there's
life.
No profit to be, because capitalism is essentially is in essence an there's futurism is built into capitalism. Capitalism requires there to be an almost irrational optimism about the future, which I think is part of the reason why capitalism in America is kind of dead in the water. But
yeah.
It requires capitalism at its height is absolutely, you know, fueled by a collective sense of the future, which is what we're pooling the capital together to build in the first place, right?
It requires that profit, the constant, yeah.
And so, like you said, it is about endless, boundless growth and expansion and a future that never fully arrives. We're always looking into the future in capitalism, right? We're eternally thinking about the future that never comes. When it comes, we're already looking into the future beyond that. And there's just no space in that mindset to think about the constraints of the world. I had this really weird, I don't know if I was dreaming or if I was just daydreaming or thinking it while I was sleeping or I was half asleep. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I thought about a lot of my people I know and myself, and the weird sort of sensitivities that we have, almost like children. There's certain things that we don't like to talk about or think about. The way that children are afraid of certain topics, you know. And I realized, you know, I started thinking about, I have this window in my apartment.
Yes.
There's one window in my apartment that opens up into a brick wall. It's the building right next door.
Wow.
If I open that window up, it's about half an inch or an inch to just a brick wall. And it's a kind of terrifying window. It's weird.
Yeah,
New York City's full of these weird windows, okay?
Right.
But it's a bricked up window. And so I just put a curtain over it, you know, because I don't want to see that. And I started realizing, like, you know, that's kind of the sense of captivity that I feel is applied to our lives. It's like we live in these luxurious settings, we could design it any way we want, we can have it any way we want, but the windows are all bricked up, and so we put curtains over them. We don't want to see the situation, which is that we're locked in here, right? This is a prison.
Uh-huh. Yes.
But any indication that this is a prison can be covered up with a curtain.
Yes.
And you can imagine that actually that opens up into open fields, you know, but it doesn't. It opens up to a fucking brick wall. I don't know what the hell that means. It's just that this sort of
terrifying image, though.
It's a terrifying image, as long as you keep those curtains closed. But once you open the curtains and you're like, holy shit, I'm locked in here. And I don't know what exactly that means, but I feel like that's the kind of existential horror that some of these recent events are starting to unveil. Basically, those curtains are the fabric that I'm talking about
when you say there's
a tear.
Yeah, yeah.
It's that curtain where when it breaks, I don't like what I'm seeing.
Yeah.
And then I realize this isn't new. This has always been there. I've just been covered.
The curtain's always been there. Mm-hmm. And you could presume, as long as you didn't part the curtain,
yeah,
you could imagine there was sky, blue sky.
Yeah.
Beyond.
Yeah.
But the moment you part it and you see it's a brick wall, that's could live with the curtain as long as it stayed still. As long as we're still there, right?
Yeah.
You didn't touch it.
And it's not something new. It's something that's been there all along, and you kind of knew.
Exactly.
You kind of knew that you weren't supposed to look behind the curtain.
Yeah.
You kind of knew that there was something behind there that you didn't want to see.
Yes, yes.
And so you just left well enough alone. You're like, what do I care? I know, you know. And sometimes you would get people would tell you about it, or you know, you would say, or you would get hints that there was something. You know, maybe the image of the brick wall isn't exactly the right one. I don't know, but I'm just saying that there was something beyond that curtain, that fabric. It was hiding something, and you knew there was ample evidence that what was underneath that was not something that you wanted to lift. And so we just didn't do it. I'm like, well, if I don't want to see it, Why would I look behind there? It's not what difference is it? Why, what would it help me? And so it's not something that we touched. We didn't open that curtain. I don't go into my bedroom and ever open that curtain because I don't want to see the brick wall. But then it gets torn up by, you know, that thing encroaches on you. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm seeing now. It's some of the most you know, I saw a tweet from this woman from Silver Spring, Maryland, which is right where I grew up. And she wrote, you know, not nuking those fucking animals is the only restraint that I support. And the only reason is because the nuclear cloud would hurt Israeli children. And I was like, God damn. Okay.
Yeah, you really went.
Yeah. I was like, what the fuck is that? You know, holy yeah, shit, man.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're saying all these things now and, openly. And if you have anything to say against it, you're attacked.
Yeah.
That is very much like that curtain. But I wanted to connect it, this really great image that you have of the curtain, back to what you said earlier about the sense that, you know, it's in the end, it's going nowhere. I think, and I want to connect it to that thread that you did this morning, which is something we wanted to talk about, right? You spoke about liberalism. And the sense of it being a kind of disguise and an emptiness beneath it. And that's, I think, what's happening now. This sense that there is nothing beyond it. The curtain, in a sense, can stand for many things. It can stand for the idea of progress. They've even given up on that. They don't even bother now to kind of, you know, sketch some sort of dream of progress. You compare that to the social democratic era of the post-war, the post-war social democratic optimism or high growth era, right, from the 50s, 60s onwards in the States and most of the West. So that's where our, you know, the science fiction of our childhood comes from, and those images of growth and of a future of some sort. It could be technological future. But you don't have that now. I think it's if these things are out there in fiction, it's pretty. It's even dystopian, right?
I think of
you
it
said it's
like,
not an ideology. You said it's
no,
a
it's not. I think that the biggest trick of all, and the reason why liberals are so detestable, it goes. I was thinking a lot about what you had said before about this concept of these blocks, right? The ontological building blocks that we use to let's say that they're based in language. I think language has a lot to do with this.
Yeah.
And these are linguistic building blocks, right?
Conceptual building blocks.
Yeah. The point of liberalism is to reduce that set into the most basic form of just these bland axioms about democracy, diversity, human rights, freedom.
Yep.
Whatever.
Yep.
And these, but they're so limited.
Yep.
As to, I think of it this way. Did you watch Andor? I don't know if you. It's a Star Wars television series.
Oh no, I haven't seen that.
Okay, I won't. It doesn't matter. The evil empire, which has always, by the way, been a metaphor for America, according to George Lucas, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just like the United States. It's a global, in this case, galactic. Okay, it's a global empire, highly bureaucratized. With a very, very brutal security state, managed by an intelligence, in part by an intelligence bureau called the ISB, which is like the CIA, Imperial Security Bureau. The IS, it's a workplace drama, this show. It's about employees inside the ISB. And it's a very progressive workplace. There's POC that are advanced to very high positions. The key player in this movie is a woman. And they talk about how they, you know, some of her male rivals try to undermine her because she's a woman, but the their boss, the director, sees that she has merit. It's a meritocracy. It's all done very well. I can imagine that the ISB, just like the CIA in real life, has liberal values that it holds very dear. You know, somewhat grotesque, propagandized HR propaganda. Let's put it that way. Posters that celebrate the values. You know, that kind of thing. Everyone worth a damn. You know, we're like everyone with a mind or an independent mind sees this stuff and dismisses it right out of hand, the way that we did with those accessories posters from the 90s. You know, like, you know, they're just decorations. I mean, no one cares about this stuff. A liberal is someone who takes that seriously. You know, a liberal is someone who looks at the bullshit wrapping paper that they put around to pretty up this joint. Doesn't understand.
HR pabulum, right? And believes it.
Yeah. And believes it. The true believers. And that's liberals. And liberal culture is growing. It's getting bigger. It is. And what was pabulum is now there's more and more pressure to really buy into this stuff. You know?
Right.
But I think what happened this time was some of the true believers out there, and there's a lot of us, you know, to some extent, I have to admit that I am a true believer in some of these ideas, like free speech. They are so grossly being violated by the institutions that are supposed to live by these. It's the same institutions that actually put this pabulum up on their walls.
Yep.
That are now saying, well, okay, like this is a a special situation. This doesn't apply here. Because I think what's going on now is it's as if in the Star Wars universe, someone had signed a letter that in support of the rebels, in support of the freedom and the right of the rebels to commit terrorist acts, you know, quote, against the empire. Well, that can't be. The whole point of the ISB is to kill those motherfuckers. The whole point of the ISB is to stop that. The whole point of the ISB is to put down the rebellion. What are you talking about? I support the rebellion. Based on what? The pabulum you saw on the walls? That's what's going on, you know. It is a failure for us to recognize the essential reality of what we are. And too much of us are children, and we believe the lie that they told us about what happened when the dog died.
Yeah.
It was never true. What are you reading this shit on the walls about?
It was never true. It was never adequate. And I think, you know, just a couple of decades ago, maybe people operated with that assumption, operated with this set of kind of HR-like principles, but had other things going on to build a world out of. But then you now have people...
You didn't take it seriously. You didn't necessarily think it was wrong. You were just like, you know, it's okay, fine. You can have that. Cool.
Yeah, these were the guidelines. These were the minimal...
No one takes it seriously.
No one thinks that this is the end all and be all, and no one absolutizes particular pieces of it.
It's the poster of the kitten. It's a poster of a kitten. You know, it says "hang in there." You know, it's a poster of the, it's a picture of the of a mountain, and it says peak performance or so. You know, whatever. Who cares about this?
Interesting. Yeah, I hadn't thought of it like that. It's a you know, the thinness of it and the fact it can coexist with and even rationalize such, utter savagery, actually, it ought to give one some pause for thought. So back to what's going on today, the killing of innocents, you know, is just flat out a war crime. You know, there's no There's really no question of that. You cannot target innocence for collective punishment, for example.
It's a moral horror.
It is a moral horror.
It can be a war crime or not a war crime. It can be legal or illegal in international law. But what it is, it is like a sin of the highest order.
Exactly. And it's
there's no greater
because it's
moral
done in front of me.
Yeah.
And I'm expected to either pass by in silence or, you know, it's not just, I thought it's not just that, oh, I, not just from a sense, a utilitarian notion, oh, there's suffering and we have to alleviate it. Look, there's always suffering. Granted, nobody noticed, but there was a massive earthquake in Afghanistan, right? Through all this, 2,000 people died. Okay, barely a mention. It's not just about that. This is not an act of nature. This is people doing this. As you say, it's the worst sort of moral horror, the worst thing that people can do to one another.
Yeah, and the fucking
you're doing
liberals,
it in front of me.
The liberals are throwing a little fucking sheet over it, and they're calling it a humanitarian crisis. I'm like, it's
exactly
okay. It is a humanitarian crisis, but it's a one that you're creating out of your own by your own decision, by your own will.
Calling it a humanitarian crisis is just utter bullshit. Yeah.
It's total bullshit. They're turning it into an act of nature, or they're turning it into an act of God, and maybe y'all think you're a God, but you're not. You're fucking people, and the rules apply to you, and these are not simple rules that are written in some UN charter or whatever. You know, these are moral rules of the universe, and your soul is on the line. I don't know why you're doing this, but you're going to drag us all down to hell with you, because okay. You know that letter?
Yep.
That those students signed? Well, you know, the thing that...
The Harvard letter? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, the one in support of Palestine and blaming Israel for everything, which is just the position of a lot of liberal Jews in Israel anyway, so I don't know why that's forbidden. But, and you know, the only people who are not allowed to think that are these South American. Asian and Muslim-appearing students.
Yeah.
A Jewish American's free to think this all they want. They won't be denied a job. But the position that they took, that some of these employers and CEOs or whatever took in demanding the names and lists of these organizations, a blacklist, said, I don't care if the student signed the letter with their own hand. The fact is that you are a member of the organization. The organization officially signed that letter, and thus you signed the letter. So you are responsible for the statement that was made. And the only way that you can get your name cleared is if you had already, before I got the list, if you had gone on the record publicly, removed yourself from that organization, and on top of that, publicly denounced with the letter itself. Okay?
Those are the rules.
Those are the rules.
Collective punishment.
Okay. Well, here are the rules then. The same rule applies. Right. If that's the rule that we're going with, okay, well then everything that the American government does, because this is a representative democracy, and the government acts in our name, everything our government is going to do, we will all be collectively responsible for it.
Yeah,
that's the same rule. Am I wrong?
Yep. Exactly. You're exactly right. You're exactly
right. Let's just take them at
when
their word.
When people attack us on that basis,
I'm okay.
It's terrorism.
Yeah.
That's the thinking of the terrorist, right? You just attack indiscriminately. Well, it's more than that. You want a certain effect. But when you just strike at some innocent in the population, if in this sense you grant that there are no innocents, then it's terrorism. And but we're hearing this. We heard this from the president of Israel. There are no innocent Palestinians. I'm sorry to actually have to, you know,
that's
even say it. Right?
If that's what he's saying.
I don't believe. Yeah.
We have to.
He gave,
I just, for some reason, I don't know, man.
Because they didn't depose their government. They elected these. He says they are responsible for the government. They could have deposed them. The last election they had was 2006, okay? And this whole matter of just pinning it just on Hamas, just that word, that's all it's far more complicated than that. Of course, there are all these different groups in there, But just calling it Hamas and using that, of course, as the proxy for Palestinians in Gaza and for Palestinians in general. So you're allowed to say anything. So we were talking about liberalism. How is it that it can coexist with and even endorse and embrace this? It was an obscene sight, frankly, to see these Western leaders fly in one after another to go and embrace Netanyahu. So latest one is, of course, Lindsey Graham, as you might expect. But one after another.
He's got a psychosexual fascination with Netanyahu, yeah. And he always has.
Netanyahu. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's the same show they did with Zelensky. So that guy looks like a sort of jilted lover now. But this is what passes for diplomacy, this sort of display of just as that sign in Times Square said, you know, standing for being human, right? So that's what it's reduced to, this kind of moral display. Why can it coexist? Why can it permit and license? Why do these liberals, how are these liberals able to license genocide? Well, it turns out, I think much of it rests on this, the dirty stuff is done in how they, in their demarcation of the human, of course. But these other guys fall outside, you know, and this is exactly how Israel has been positioned or has been sold, promoted over the last decades as this model democracy. They could do no wrong, right? This is the only democracy in the Middle East, et cetera, et cetera. Yes, it is a great democracy for Jews. So democracy is completely, it's completely consistent with apartheid, it turns out. And everything, so much rests on the way you kind of demarcate the human. What is and the group? So I mean, this is a very familiar observation, familiar thought, right? In the U.S., you had the Declaration of Independence, and then you have in the Constitution, "We the people." But who are the people? It turns out, sort of male property owners, white male property owners at first, and then it's, you know, of course it's consistent with there being slaves, but they play this trick each time. They do this to us each time. That's part of the horror of it. It's thinness, and then at the same time, the clarity with which they seem to be able to delineate the human. You know, you have this act. In democracy, you set up a polity by going, okay, we the people. But all the magic is done there. All the amazing, what I call the theological stuff, is done in that first step by defining who the we are. How did that come about? I mean, you think about it in constitutional terms. Who defines who's in and who's out? Who's the we? Well, the we is, it's circular after a bit, right? The we is whoever the Constitution says is the we. I mean, who are the citizens? Well, the citizens are who the citizens say they are. It's an absolutely circular thing. But to those outside it, it immediately draws a line, and those outside, you can do whatever the hell you want to them, because it's all about freedom and the freedom to do what you want, right? So that dirty thing they do, you know, that's sort of very visible to me.
Yeah, I think also in Israel, where we're looking at sort of this formal, I think the problem that people are starting to have with Israel is not necessarily the discrimination against Palestinians or the segregation and the treatment of them, which we've basically, I think, you know, We've been fine with that for,
yeah,
for
decades. We were willing to close an eye to that.
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't really bother me. I think what really bothers even people like the Benny Morris and even conservatives in Israel now is the formalization of that into, saying outright that that's what we are, right? Saying outright that we are an apartheid state. Formalizing it so that the veil comes off.
Exactly.
And the thing is exposed formally for what it is, you know?
Yes, yes.
I think of this, I just have a lot of images in my head these days, man. Another is this construction of, you know, this, I don't know what to call it, a sort of citadel that is really the headquarters, you know, like a the physical manifestation of this, like, dystopian fascist state that we write about in fiction and we sometimes refer to in dystopian futuristic terms. Like, if we're not careful, that's what we're going to turn into, right? And we're building it, but as we build it, you know, like with the construction projects that you see in New York City and stuff, it's draped in this thin green netting it's being constructed, so you can't see it. And on top of that, now what they do is they actually either print an image onto it to give you a sense of what they're building, or they'll project an image onto it to give you an idea of what's underneath what they're building. And it's as if they're, the whole time that they were building this citadel of just doom, they've been wrapping it in with these very childish images to just totally placate us. That they were building a big pool, like the Google headquarters. There's a pool, a ball pool. There's a giant slide for children. There's it's like an adult daycare. There's a cafeteria with all your favorite foods. There's a dog grooming service. There's a daycare center, right? Like this very almost sickly utopian view of what they're building. And then when they're done, it all comes off and it's not at all what you thought it was going to be. It's exactly the thing they warned you about. It's here. How did we get to the dystopian future? How did we avoid all the warnings and get to the point where we're seeing just these openly fascist, Nazi-istic type images? Openly fascist. Openly just telling people, if you signed a letter saying the wrong thing about Israel, you are not welcome. You are not able to have a job. We are going to work to make sure that you never get a job. And we're not even going to hide it. I'm just saying, allegiance to Israel ain't optional. What the fuck is wrong with you?
You can't
get a job after you said Israel is to blame. And I'm
you're morally
tainted.
Where is this? You're morally tainted. But not just morally, security-wise. You know, there's also the tinge of being you're pro-terror.
You know what I felt like?
You're pro-Hamas.
You know what I felt like?
Mm-hmm.
I felt like a fool for being surprised. I felt like a child.
I have a lot of that feeling these days.
I was like, I'm an idiot.
Yeah.
How did I not see that this was the my anger is built on childish beliefs in these ideals of freedom.
But dude,
that's
what we started with. It's not that we didn't know this, right? You're disappointed with yourself. I have this. Maybe it's like yours. I knew this stuff. It's just something else to see it plastered there in front of you.
It's the rupture. I knew what was behind the veil.
I didn't want. Yeah, exactly.
I just didn't want to look.
Yeah.
And then I was caught unprepared.
Yep.
And I said, "Fuck! I knew it was that." What the fuck was I thinking? What was I thinking?
This is a point I make quite a lot. And it's not a point about hypocrisy, about the need for sort of a necessary hypocrisy to keep society going. You know, all those theories about how we have to tell ourselves the noble lie. It's all butchery and savagery underneath, but we have to tell ourselves some lie, you know, about how it's not that.
It's not really that.
It's that there needs to be, even when people are doing these things, when these things are operative, it makes a difference when it's right up there in front of you and they're declaring it. Because at that point, they're doing something to you, to your integrity. You, it's zero deniability left. I can't, in charity or in sort of out of expedience, ignore what I just saw. And then you're also, because we are social beings, you're expecting society to move along with that in the center, with that damn thing in the center, right? That thing naked in the center. It does make a difference.
This is end of part one of a two-part podcast. If you want to listen to the second part, you can support us over at patreon.com/planamag for access to bonus episodes, including the second part of this pod and access to our Discord chat server.